The meeting is called to order. Representative Brainerd has thoroughly studied the minutes and moves the minutes. Right there.
Well, Mr. Chair, at a quick perusal, the minutes do look accurate.
Thank you. Is there a second, somebody? Oh, we don't need seconds. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, not. You win the first motion of the committee. Today we're just continuing on the testimony on the very important area of mental health on children. And the first testifier is Mary. Oh, there she is, Mary Regan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. We're a membership association of treatment services for children, adolescents, and their families. Our 46 member organizations operate over 250 programs around the state serving children with mental health, juvenile justice, child welfare needs, as well as homeless youth. The children's mental health system in Minnesota includes a continuum of services. The continuum includes outpatient services offered by community mental health centers, private professionals and other agencies, in-home treatment services, school link services, day treatment, residential treatment, partial hospital, and inpatient services. These programs in total serve children from early childhood through adolescence and into early adulthood and their families. You heard yesterday quite a bit about school-linked mental health services, so I want to focus today on some of the other services in the continuum. And for a little context, when I began my career in Minnesota in 1982 at a residential treatment center, there were about 1,200 residential treatment beds in the state. The average length of stay in the program that I was working in was 3.5 years. At the same time, Abbott Northwestern had a specialty psychiatric hospital called Willow Street, and the average length of stay in that hospital was 6 months. Today, there are about 750 residential treatment beds in the state with an average length of stay of 7 months, and hospital lengths of stay average 7 days. So quite a lot of change in that very long period of time. But much of this change can be attributed to the relatively recent development of a continuum of community-based services that keep more children at home, out of more intensive services such as residential treatment and hospitals, and in school. You heard mention of Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports yesterday, CTSS. CTSS is a comprehensive package of services: psychotherapy for children and their families, skill development services to restore or develop healthy functioning, and behavioral aid services to provide support for children and families as they practice what they've learned in therapy. These services can be delivered in the family's home, in school, or other settings that work for individual families. Dr. Garrett talked yesterday about the difficulty some families have getting to appointments. These services are brought to those families, which allows them, despite the barriers of distance or transportation, to receive the help they and their children need. The psychotherapy and skill building services can also be offered in a package that's integrated or connected with education services, and this is called day treatment for those children who need more intensity of intervention and support. Unfortunately, as was mentioned by Dr. Edwall yesterday, these services are not available in all parts of our state, nor are they funded to cover anything other than direct services. Dr. Sanders mentioned yesterday that the school link providers spend about 30% of their time on key activities like ongoing assessment and evaluation, consultation with other providers, educators, and schools. CTSS providers have no option to get paid for these key activities or to spend time with families, helping them understand their child's mental illness, treatment options, and ongoing assessment of appropriateness of those treatment options. This is especially an issue in early childhood mental health services. Some families are understandably reluctant to consider that their child's behaviors are really symptoms of a mental illness. And despite the growing availability of effective interventions, these children, who may be repeatedly getting kicked out of childcare centers, may not get the services they need without the support and education from providers prior to actual treatment. Cultural barriers also exist to access and identification of mental illness, especially with newer immigrant communities, and are exacerbated by the lack of culturally competent professionals and culturally specific providers. We do know more all the time about what works and the importance of continuity of care across services. For example, as part of our mission, our association's mission, to ensure quality in member services, we conduct outcome evaluation on our residential programs. What we know from post-discharge interviews with families or placing workers is that most children do significantly improve their ability to function at home and in the community. Some examples from our most recent data analysis include some of these facts. Prior to admission to residential mental health treatment, 34% of the children were able to live with their families. At discharge and 6 months after discharge, 66% were able to live at home. 63% of children had prior hospitalizations. At follow-up, only 3% were hospitalized. 93% of children were attending or had completed their education at follow-up. 92% had no further delinquency adjudications. But our hard data only covers the first 6 months after children leave. Yesterday, Dr. Michael Bust mentioned the long-term outcomes as a concern for children returning from residential treatment. We do know that children who leave residential placements without a transition plan and without the ability to continue their care with community-based professionals can struggle in school and at home. And the outcome of only 66% of the children being able to live with their families is not one we feel is good enough. This area of transition and longer-term support is an area where our members are working really hard to develop a continuity of care model that would ensure ongoing care without the disruptions in the treatment approach or the professionals working with the family. This model includes identification of children who appear to be headed toward an out-of-home placement in a residential treatment-like setting and involves intensive community-based services. If, as a result of those services, the child still needs to be placed, that placement is much shorter in duration, 45 days typically, and involves the community-based professional continuing the work with that family and that child during the placement. Then, when the child comes back, the commitment is to stay involved intensively with that family and child for up to a year. The initial, right now this is being piloted with two agencies in two separate parts of the state, and the initial data suggests that long-term functioning and stability are much improved, in addition to certainly the cost savings of the shorter length of stay in residential treatment. The funding for this, though, is really being cobbled together by arrangements with particular counties that have been interested in this, medical assistance, and some private insurance companies. If we had funding for care coordination and transition planning, we will be able to provide this to many, many more children and families. We also see the racial disparities that were talked about yesterday in access to treatment versus our corrections placements. For example, in our mental health residential treatment programs, 35% are children of color. In our corrections residential programs, 87% are children of color. For Native American youth, only 7% are being served in residential treatment programs, while they represent 47% of our private agency foster care placements. Some of this disparity has to do with even more severe lack of culturally competent and culturally specific providers. There are some very innovative, culturally specific services that have been or are being developed through the tribes on certain reservations. But there remain many Native children and families who are without access to culturally competent services. In addition to those children who access the continuum of mental health services, we see mental illness in many of the children served in our programs for homeless youth, child welfare placements, and correction settings. Multiple testifiers mentioned yesterday that 70% of youth in corrections programs have an emotional disorder. all of our corrections providers have begun to address this by either adding a mental health certification to their existing program or designating some of the units on their program to serve specialized needs kids, or through contracting with community-based services to work with their residents. You also heard yesterday about the ACEs study and the long-term impact on the overall health of individuals with multiple ACEs. The research is clear that responding in an effective way to youth with those histories involves an organizational and a clinical approach that's trauma-informed. We have been collaborating with Dr. Edwall and her staff in the Children's Mental Health Division for several years on training clinicians in our residential treatment programs and CTSS providers on trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy, which is an evidence-based practice and an evidence-based approach to treatment of these children and families. We know what works. We know that the earlier children and families can receive the help they need, the better the long-term outcomes in every area: mental health, physical health, education, criminal justice, homelessness, and on and on. We must learn from the tragedies at Columbine, Red Lake, and Sandy Hook, and invest in our children, their mental health, and their and our future. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you get us a copy of the statistics? Because you cited a lot.
Certainly.
I was trying to write down, and boy, I couldn't come close.
I have many
and I'm
more.
I'm probably not the only one.
Yes, Mr.
Okay, thank you. Is it Dr.
Gewertz?
Gewertz? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Abby Gewertz. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. My area of focus is the impact of trauma on children and families. I want to start with a story. It's a true story. Over the past couple of years, my colleagues and I have spent many weekends at family preparation and reintegration academies with members of the 2,600-strong 1st Brigade Combat Team of the Minnesota Army National Guard. Their families said goodbye and then hello again, often for the second, third, or fourth times, to husbands, wives, fathers, and mothers for over a year while they served our country in operations enduring in Iraqi freedom. We provided a workshop on parenting through deployment where families learned, shared, and gathered ideas about how to help their children. Jim and Mary have two children, ages 12 and 16. Jim was preparing to deploy for the second time. Last time Jim was deployed, their 16-year-old son, Jim Jr., then 12, had a very difficult time in school. Previously a straight-A student, he got into fights, was suspended several times, and received very poor grades, prompting his teacher to tell Mary that he would need to be moved from his advanced classes to classes where he could keep up better. Mary shared the information that Jim was deployed, but felt that the school couldn't really understand what was going on. She knew of no other military children at their son's school. In preparation for this deployment, Mary and Jim started talking with Jim Jr. and their daughter Stacy to prepare them. Stacy had already had nightmares about their dad getting injured over there. When Mary told her story in our family workshop, several other parents in the room nodded their heads, murmuring, "Same with us." Many families, first time deployed or not, report not knowing what is typical in their children's reactions to deployment. Talking with mental health professionals isn't often considered an option, and opportunities for parenting support are scarce. Traumatic stress is a natural response to an overwhelming event or events, the threat or actual harm to life or limb, or to the life of somebody close to you. These include man-made and natural disasters, tornadoes, earthquakes, flooding, child sexual and physical abuse, exposure to domestic and community violence, war, and terrorism. A recent study found that over two-thirds of children had experienced at least one traumatic event prior to the age of 16. Fortunately, the past two decades, and particularly the past decade, have seen a remarkable increase in our awareness of the detrimental effects of traumatic events on children, and on services and policies to help those children and their families find a path to wellness. Over the past decade, much of this work has been galvanized by the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, a congressional initiative started in 2001. This network has contributed to a revolution in how services are provided to traumatized children and their families. through unique collaborations where treatment developers, community service providers, families and consumers, training and technical assistance providers, and national and local collaborators work in tandem to support children and families. The network bridges science and service in the most relevant and high-impact way. Here in Minnesota, we are fortunate to have been funded as a network center for over 7 years. Our center AMBIT network is a university community collaboration funded since 2005 and the only currently funded network among the five upper Midwestern states. Over the past 7 years, we've partnered with multiple community organizations serving traumatized children, as well as the state's Department of Human Services, to increase access to quality care for traumatized kids and their families. We've trained almost 4,000 mental health professionals, police, school providers, juvenile justice and child welfare providers, medical and other professionals in how to support kids exposed to traumatic events. We've provided 8-year-long learning collaborative trainings to 214 mental health providers throughout the state in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. These providers from over 40 community agencies and residential treatment centers have touched the lives of thousands of children with mental health problems who have been exposed to traumatic stress. The data on 850 children treated with trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy show that children make significant improvements with reductions in post-traumatic distress, depression, and related problems. Nonetheless, we have touched just 1% of the licensed mental health providers in this state. We've worked with community providers to support parents who have experienced traumatic events so that they can promote their children's resilience. And we know that parents are their children's best teachers. In recognition of the fact that so many children don't make it to mental health clinics, we completed parenting groups with Somali mothers who fled war in their home country and often lost their own parents, enduring horrific hardships before coming to the country and being expected to know how to parent the American way. These mothers shared with us the skills that they are learning and how those skills have changed the way that they and their husbands engage with their children and subsequently their children's outcomes. And thanks to funding from the National Institutes of Health, we have developed and are testing the first parenting program for parents who have deployed and are reintegrating to promote their children's adjustment. In addition to the services provided, our work has resulted in some policy changes. For example, some of our local insurers now reimburse for the 90-minute sessions required for trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy rather than the standard 60-minute sessions. Our state completed a modifier to the Medicaid code to reimburse for trauma-informed parent training, even when children are not present. Prior research has shown that parent training, whether or not children are present in the consulting room, is highly effective. So what have we learned? First, far more children than we ever imagined have been exposed to traumatic events. Second, providers lack the training opportunities to respond to the needs of these children. It takes time and financial resources to learn how to provide effective services for traumatized children. Third, traumatized children don't often present to traditional outpatient mental health clinics. Their families may go to community centers, churches, shelters, or food shelves for services. They may show up in foster homes, police cars, or detention centers. So we need to reach out and provide services where children are. Almost all of them are in school. So schools offer a special opportunity to provide mental health services. I'd like to end by telling you about the work of one of our Minnesota clinicians in one of our local community mental health agencies who participated in learning trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and evidence-based practice. She shared the following from a letter that from a 16-year-old girl whom she treated. This teenager had a history of exposure to abuse and violence over several years, foster care placement, and subsequent adoption. She'd received multiple mental health diagnoses and had been on several different medications prior to participating in therapy. She wrote, "This therapy helped me with an issue that has been haunting me since it happened 8 years ago. It is no longer scaring me. No therapists have been able to help me with that before. After completing treatment, her behavioral difficulties subsided, her mood improved, and her symptoms of depression and anxiety was significantly reduced. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you an initiative that is changing child trauma services in our state. The services and supports make a world of difference in the lives of children and families recovering in the aftermath of traumatic events. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for setting aside the time for yesterday and today's hearings on children's mental health.
Thank you. Representative Newton, do you want to come down and you can ask questions later or anything? We're holding questions till the end. If there's any other legislators, I didn't see, but come on down. Okay, Linda?
Mr. Chairman and representative to community meetings, thank you for your interest and time supporting our children. The hope of children having and reaching their dreams is worth our time as legislators, professionals, parents, neighbors, employers, friends, teachers, and most of all human beings. It's the right thing to do. Watching our children suffer, fail at school, in the community, and at home, and then possibly entering the juvenile justice system only to live in and out of institutions is not what anyone would want for our own children, neighbors, or family members. I've had the opportunity as a master's prepared mental health professional for the past 26 years, the last 12 within a correctional department. I'm here to express my personal opinions as well as the work of the Children's Subcommittee for Children's Mental Health and the Juvenile Justice Mental Health Work Group. Much of the following information has been reported in the 2012 report to the governor and legislature. I'd like to begin by recognizing that I have the opportunity to work with those in juvenile justice, including probation officers, supervisors, judges, attorneys, teachers, and all those that support this work. I realize that my work providing mental health services is a small but very important part of servicing youth in the juvenile justice system. The goal of corrections is to provide safety in our communities, provide offender rehabilitation, and reparation to our victims. I'd like to highlight some of the work that's being done in our department as well as across the state. I'd also like to share a few needs and barriers to meet these needs within this population. I'd first like to support what others presented in yesterday's hearing and today as well regarding early intervention, ACEs, trauma-informed care, school-based mental health, and the importance of culturally sensitive interventions. These services are so important, and they can help our youth from entering the juvenile justice system. Now to our youth involved in juvenile justice. The 1999 U.S. Surgeon General's report on mental health found that approximately 21% of all children and youth experience a mental health disorder, and that half are severe enough to cause impairment at home, school, and in the community. A 2006 study by the National Center of Mental Health and Juvenile Justice found that 70% of youth in juvenile justice suffer from a mental health disorder. Over one-third experience a disorder so severe that it impairs their ability to function. Unrecognized and or untreated mental health problems significantly contribute to a youth's chances of becoming engaged in the juvenile justice system. The lack of early identification of mental health needs and corresponding provision of treatment services to address these needs often results in increased and more costly juvenile justice involvement in the lives of these children. Once a youth becomes involved in the juvenile justice system and is detained or incarcerated, access to effective, successful mental health treatment is less likely to occur. In fact, as they are incarcerated, they lose their ability for medical assistance. And the likelihood of further and deeper engagement in the system increases, often up and through adulthood. I work directly with youth detained in a juvenile facility, in a correctional day treatment program, or with youth in or at risk of out-of-home placement. What's the profile of these kids that I work with? Kids of color are clearly overrepresented. Kids with problems with attention, concentration, organization, and impulsivity, as well as mood dysregulation. Other common diagnoses, anxiety, including post-traumatic stress disorder, mood disorders, psychotic disorders, such as early-onset schizophrenia, developmental disorders, including autism spectrum disorders, reactive attachment disorder, low cognitive ability, learning disabilities, and other neurocognitive disorders. Girls with significant histories of trauma that have high needs but are very low risk in our communities. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. These are all outside of the basic scope of probation services. In addition to these services we do treat, families without necessary skills to address these problematic behaviors in their children, or the mental illness that they're suffering from, or the chemical dependency, all while suffering from their own mental illness, chemical addictions, or history of ACEs. Criminal charges that we typically see include domestic assaults, disorderly conduct, theft, assaults, drug paraphernalia, and possession. Crime rates have decreased, yet our work has increased due to the change in profile of youth on probation. Mary Reagan demonstrated our loss of services over the past decades and some of the replacement. They're not enough. We've lost residential treatment programs, day treatment programs, group homes, state and regional hospital beds, while schools' challenges have increased and lost resources while they increase their class sizes. We've moved closer to a crisis mode at times rather than prevention. This is costly and harmful to our children, families, and communities. The resources available to youth with mental illness often exclude the juvenile justice population. Most are not equipped to treat aggressive youth with mental illness. Detention has become the mental health hospital without doctors or mental health professionals. Certainly, we wouldn't want to receive treatment for heart disease from a podiatrist, right? Outpatient therapists also struggle with our youth. Working with this youth is a specialty, and there's not enough appropriate training. Juvenile justice employees do not receive adequate mental health training. Some initiatives that are working will be discussed now. In response to an understanding that mental illness is overrepresented in the juvenile justice population, the 2003 legislature required youth in juvenile justice and child welfare to receive mental health screening. According to the Department of Human Services, since 2005, approximately 31,800 screenings of youth in the juvenile justice population have taken place through this initiative. Screening of youth in the juvenile justice and child protection populations is a positive contribution to identifying youth with mental health needs. The Department of Human Services distributes grant funds to counties that subsidize the screening activities and assist with needed treatment services for uninsured youth. The funds are allocated based on the number of screenings reported by each county. I administer and follow these mental health screenings. They're very important. This is a time to truly recognize unmet mental health needs, histories of trauma so that they may be treated, and work directly with parents to coordinate services. This is an opportunity to identify youth also appropriate for mental health case management. I'd like to recommend continued support of this legislation with resources, as well as instituting statewide data collection and service follow-up, and implement protocols and data tracking regarding follow-up post-screening and referral to an engagement at service. And ethnicity data to the screening, added ethnicity data to the screening system to help identify disparities. Once youth are detained, youth are more likely to be formally charged, found delinquent, and committed to youth correction facilities than similarly situated youngsters. According to one Florida study, youth detained pending court appearances were three times as likely to be committed to a correction facility as youth with identical offending histories who were not detained. Detention, therefore, might be thought of as a slippery slope into the juvenile justice's deep end. Detention is associated with negative long-term outcomes. Youth who spend time in custody are less likely to complete high school, avoid rearrest, find employment, and form stable families. They're also likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. Once youth are formally detained in the juvenile justice system, even if barriers resulted from unidentified, unmet mental health needs, it often begins a path towards frequent reengagement in the system with poor outcomes. Access to successful mental health treatment is usually not available. Another promising intervention that's happened over the past several years includes the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. In a matter of time, I'm going to skip over most of that. It's outlined in the governor's report, though just a snapshot that, the core elements of the JDI model include collaboration among the local juvenile court, probation agency, prosecutors, defenders, and other governmental entities, as well as community organizations, including a formal partnership to cooperatively plan, implement, and assess detention reforms. It involves collection and utilization of data to diagnose the system's problems and proclivities, assess the impact of various reforms, and assure that decisions are grounded in hard facts rather than anecdotes. Objective admission screening to identify which youth actually pose a substantial public safety. And my favorite, intensive monitoring of conditions of confinement for youth in secure custody to ensure that detention facilities are safe and appropriate care. I'd like to finish with a list of recommendations that I do not have time to address individually due to time constraints. These are my recommendations. Continue to support practices that divert youth from juvenile justice system. Support JDI with an additional emphasis of data collections regarding mental health incidents as well as services. Mandate treatment of mental illness while detained or incarcerated. Early identification with continued funding and expansion of the mental health screening mandate. Address need for improvement of access to services for detained youth, such as MA reimbursement while detained or for bundled evidence-based practices. Better collection of data regarding outcomes for youth with mental illness in the juvenile justice system. This would not only be looking at recidivism, which our correctional data systems typically look at, rather than improvement in mental health functioning. Increase collaboration between state departments to include DOC. DOC to take a more active role in treatment of children with mental illness. We'd like them to join the Children's Cabinet team working to implement ACE strategies. Training for mental health professionals working with juvenile justice involved youth and mental health training for juvenile justice employees. Study and address staffing requirements for detention facilities to include mental health professionals with clear authority to direct mental health treatment. Address training needs of juvenile justice employees to include mental health and trauma-informed care. Address training needs of mental health professionals working with the juvenile justice population. Again, I'd like to thank you for your interest and work towards supporting our children.
Thank you. Andrea? You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, for having given me the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Andrea Simonette, and I am the director for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Programs of Catholic Charities, St. Paul, Minneapolis. We have a continuum of services for homeless youth, including street and school outreach programs, emergency shelters, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. I'm here today to talk about mental illness and mental health services as they relate to youth homelessness. Research consistently shows the strong relationship between mental illness and homelessness. Each year, 50 to 60% of the youth that we serve in our shelter have mental health issues. This data is similar to the 2009 Wilder research data, which found that 46% of homeless youth reported significant mental health problems, and 25% had been told by a medical professional in the previous 2 years of that survey that they had a significant health problem. Wilder also reported that 31% of homeless youth had considered suicide and 20% had attempted suicide. Youth who do not get the mental health care needed are extremely vulnerable to long-term homelessness, dropping out of school, chemical dependency, exploitation, suicide, and a cycle of poverty. Most youth we serve in the shelter have touched the mental health system to some degree before coming to us. But we're not provided the consistent ongoing mental health services and care that they needed in order to maintain stability. Youth often come to the shelter with a list of diagnoses that they've received through the years but have little or no understanding what they mean. They often come into the shelter with pill bottles and prescriptions for medications that they don't understand why they are taking. Perhaps one of the most concerning situations that we see in the shelter is youth who clearly need a structured environment in order to be safe, but are being directly discharged from a psychiatric hospital to our shelter. I have a couple stories to illustrate why this is such a serious issue. Aaron is a 17-year-old male who was referred to us from a psychiatric hospital. He stayed at the hospital for 2 weeks before being referred to our homeless shelter. Paperwork that we obtained from the psychiatric hospital after he came to us included the following information. He has cannabis and alcohol dependency along with cocaine, ecstasy, crystal meth, and cigarette abuse. He has experienced trauma from seeing a friend murdered and from continued witnessing a violence between stepfather and mother. He has very little connection with any family member. He has a history of large sexual exposure. He is self-injurious and cuts on arms. He has major depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, and psychotic disorder. He has a sense of worthlessness and guilt. He has impaired thinking, concentration, decision making. He reported that he, quote, sees the devil and the devil is trying to kill him or get him to do acts which are harmful to others, unquote. He has destructive behavior, aggressive behavior, and anger at his mother. This youth was at the hospital for 2 weeks before being discharged to our homeless shelter. His discharge plan stated that he was, quote, being released to a homeless shelter per his mother's request, unquote. While the discharge plan stated that he should attend all doctor appointments, there were none scheduled for him. While the discharge plan stated that he needed to arrange a medication follow-up appointment within 2 weeks, there was no information on how to do that. In addition, the discharge plan laid out several steps that required the engagement of an active, involved parent. For example, the plan stated that the parent should ensure that your child does not run out of medications. It said that it is recommended that you have arranged for your child to be seen by his or her primary physician within 4 to 6 weeks. But this same plan had acknowledged earlier in the document that Aaron had no relationship with any family members. The discharge plan goes on to state that Aaron should, one, avoid friends or people who are known drug or alcohol users, two, stay in a, quote, healthy environment free from temptation, consider a sober home environment and sober school, three, obtain a sponsor, and four, have limited access to cell phones, computers, and Facebook for extended periods of time. While these probably were all very good recommendations for some, they were very unrealistic for Aaron and unrealistic in a homeless shelter setting. As you might surmise, Aaron's stay with us was unsuccessful. His needs far exceeded our ability to keep him safe. One day after he left our shelter, he ended up back at the same hospital as a result of taking half of the bottle of medication that had been prescribed to him at his first visit at that hospital 1 week before. For this second visit, he was there 1 week when the hospital called us again looking for a shelter bed. We did not have one available. Another quick story I want to tell is that of Joseph, who came to our shelter directly from a psychiatric hospitalization as a result. He was in the hospital as a result of a suicide attempt. When he came to our shelter, his paperwork stated that he had major depressive disorder, chronic depression, oppositional defiant disorder, aggressiveness, and thoughts of suicide. In addition, he had been previously diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, reactive attachment disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and polysubstance abuse. The paperwork stated that during his stay at the hospital, he needed to be moved from one unit of the hospital to another unit due to a, quote, episode of defiance of staff and incidents of self-injurious behavior, unquote. Just 3 days after Joseph had to be moved from one part of the hospital to another directly due to instability, aggression, and a risk to self, he was discharged to our emergency shelter. Unlike Aaron from the first story, Joseph's discharge plan did indicate a referral to a residential treatment program that he was going to be potentially able to move into within a month. The discharge plan stated that, quote, the patient was to be discharged to Hope Street Shelter for respite while waiting residential program, unquote. Unfortunately, due to the appropriateness of the shelter setting in relation to Joseph's needs, he was only able to stay with us a short time before being asked to leave for possessing large amounts of marijuana and dealing at the shelter. We don't know if Joseph ever made it to that residential treatment program, though we are doubtful. His mother called a few months later asking if we had a shelter bed available. We did not. The staff and I believe that if Joseph had been able to stay in the hospital or had been in a structured, stable setting in the weeks prior to the residential treatment program, that plan may have been successful. At the shelter, we make every effort to push back on referrals that do not seem appropriate, but since we are a homeless shelter, we usually don't have any information about the youth before they end up in our program. What Aaron and Joseph both needed were prevented from obtaining was consistent, steady, ongoing mental health services. Currently, youth are bounced around our system in a disconnected and choppy fashion that leaves them falling through the cracks. I wish I could say that Aaron and Joseph's situations were rare, but I cannot. In the past year, our shelter alone has received approximately a call per month from a shelter looking to refer youth. And in just the past 2 weeks, we have received 4 calls from psychiatric hospitals referring youth. This number is no doubt under-reporting, given that we do not obtain referral information on every call. I also want to briefly mention another issue that we see at the shelter, and that is the youth whose mental health drastically deteriorates during their stay with us as a result of not gaining much-needed access to mental health services. This is especially the case for youth who are showing early signs of schizophrenia and disorder, a disorder whose onset of symptoms typically occurs in young adulthood. These youth often have to stay in our shelter for many months, waiting to access mental health services and appropriate housing. This is despite fierce advocacy and intensive support services that our shelter staff provide. So in summary, the barriers that we see in the shelter are, one, youth having been labeled with multiple diagnoses and given multiple medications without having any understanding of what that means or what they are for. Two, youth being released directly from hospitalization into homelessness because there are no resources. Three, youth being released from hospitalization into shelters without any realistic aftercare plan. And four, youth's mental health worsening as a result of their length of stay in our shelter due to an inability to access services or appropriate housing. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. And our next testifier, are you from South High School?
Yes, I am.
Don't you wish you went to Patrick Henry? there's a couple? Okay, just introduce yourselves.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, my name is Carter Dennison, and I'm a senior at South High School, and I'm a leader of Silver Ribbon Campaign. Today with me, I have a few of our other leaders and some of our members. We are here today to tell you about our novel approach to supporting students with mental health concerns. Silver Ribbon Campaign is a student-led educational and support group that was started 10 years ago at South High School. Two students, with help from an amazing school social worker, Eva Newbeck, started this group. The first few years only saw a small, dedicated group of students attend meetings, but in the last 4 years, I've watched the group grow from 20 to over 200 and because of limited space, we are only able to have 150 students attend each meeting. Each member or student who attends is different in their own way. We see students from all races and backgrounds. Some suffer from mental health issues themselves, or others have friends or family members who do. Or they just attend meetings to gain a greater understanding about what very normal students and people go through. SRC is a support group, and because of this, we are able to have these meetings during the school day for 1 hour twice a month. Teachers are happy to let their students attend a meeting during their class because SRC is such a unique opportunity. Each meeting, we have a speaker present to us their personal experiences and knowledge on any number of mental illnesses. We have had students speak about their own struggles, which are some of my favorite meetings because of the down-to-earth and real atmosphere that is present when a peer shares that they face depression, anxiety, and have dealt with an eating disorder. Our speakers range from musicians, artists, authors, doctors, and licensed mental health professionals who keep us well-rounded by educating us on a scientific as well as the personal aspect of mental illness. At South High, we are able to provide students with mental illness a safe and welcoming environment where they are encouraged to share and talk about their experiences with mental health issues. Over the past few years, we have seen an increased number in the amount of students seeking out help for their mental health disorders. Already this year, our therapists and our school-based clinics are unable to take any new students because of such a large demand. Of course, they are still able to find these students the help they need through other means. In fact, our social workers have facilitated co-located therapists who already this semester have seen 25 students for a total of 150 visits with an approximate 83% successful show rate. The work that SRC has done has opened doors for students in our community. They are able to learn and accept that anyone can be a part of the 10% of students who face a mental health disorder. They can learn about an illness that a family member or friend faces and learn how they can help or comfort them. At every meeting, something special happens. You experience a different side of people you see every day, and you accept them for who they are. There is no judgment or shame, and attending SRC has become a blessing and privilege to most. We hope we are able to continue this program at our school for years to come. The support group is nearly costless effort. Every speaker volunteers their time and often will leave us with a piece of literature they have written that we can add to our own bookcase in our own library. We were given a grant by the South High Foundation to purchase these SRC t-shirts to sell to students who proudly wear them around school. SRC is something that I've cherished for the past 4 years, and I hope to eventually that we can bring SRC to other schools in the city and around the state. and to begin to bust the stigma on mental health illness at an early age and bridge the gap between having a mental health issue and seeking out services.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Clara Schultz, and I'm also a senior at high school and a leader as well. And SRC is something that is hard to explain, but it's much easier to understand once you see it. The day after our most recent meeting, I walked the halls during my lunch and spontaneously asked those of my peers who I've regularly seen at meetings why they go to SRC and what they get out of SRC. The insight and honesty that I saw from my peers was shocking to even me. And of course, when you you think that you yourself believe that your peers are smart and intelligent, but I just was shocked at their responses, because I would have never expected what they said. And this is just a quick video. It is still a work in progress, and we apologize for the abrupt ending, because technology isn't always reliable.
Why did you want to speak at SRC?
I decided to speak at SRC because I have personally suffered from mental illness, and I think that it's really important to let other students that are suffering from the same thing as me know that it's okay to speak about it, and it's okay to talk openly and have a community that supports you. And also, I wanted to let people know that not only does it affect you mentally and in your relationships, but it also affects you to the point where your schoolwork isn't able to be done as well as you could. It really affected my grades negatively, and it affected my GPA, and I'm worried about my chances of getting into college because I suffer from a mental illness that dragged down my GPA a lot, and it's not where it should be. And now that I'm recovered, I am back on track, I'm back to getting all A's, and it's like I'm completely a different person than I was the time last year.
I wanted to be a guest speaker at SRC because I think there's a lot of stigma around depression and suicide, and it's a lot more common in high schools than I think people think. I also think that people don't really understand what depression is. It's not just being sad. There are a lot of other aspects that go into it, and there are a lot of developmental things and genetic things. It's caused by a lot more things than people think. It can affect a lot more things than people think. It's a big issue in today's schools, and I personally know plenty of people who suffer from it who don't really have anyone to talk to about it, so I think it's a bigger issue than people think.
Mr. Berglund, as a teacher, why do you value SRC?
When we study psychology, we find that mental health issues are always, anything can drive you nuts at a certain time. And so it just seems how well you can deal with your frustrations, your life hassles, changes, and conflicts in life. People have difficult moments and they have stress-free moments. And just being able to understand and recognize your own mental health issues and your peace of mind is such a valuable way of helping you work your way through life as you try to reach the best person you can possibly be.
SRC isn't something that can be duplicated perfectly or mass-produced in a one-size-fits-all governmental program. But the idea that there can be groups who focus on social-emotional learning through this or a similar model and yet tweak it to fit their students and their school is not unfathomable. Our group's main goal is to reduce stigma and to promote mental health awareness. Exposure and education is key to achieving that goal. SRC exposes students to mental health issues and shows them that having a mental illness is nothing to be ashamed of. Having students see their peers and classmates discuss mental illness so openly has had a dramatic effect on our school atmosphere. Instead of finding out someone has a mental illness being a shocking, scandalous factoid that leads to bullying and harassment, it's viewed by peers as more of a fact of life. Yesterday I sat here and heard about how those communities with some of the most mental health issues are those with large minority populations and high poverty rates. But in our school, with a very diverse population in an inner city district, with our percentage of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch above 50%, the stigma behind mental illness is at an all-time low, while the discussion and awareness is at an all-time high. To highlight the amount of mental health discourse within our school, we have distributed to you copies of our school newspaper, which this month has published 4 articles pertaining to mental health. Something that may seem uncommon at a high school, but we believe that this demonstrates the far-reaching impact we've had on the culture of our school. Our goal here today is to encourage and motivate others to work within the school system to continue to increase professional support for those with mental illness, while remembering that anyone in the school system can start their own SRC. The idea that all school children will have the opportunity to speak about mental illness openly in a safe place may seem very grandiose, but to us at SRC, it seems very possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Suzette?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for allowing the opportunity to speak here today. I'm a parent of a young adult who lives with mental illness. My name's Suzette Cheely, and I want to share with you my story. A few years ago, I dropped my son off to class, and as I looked back, there he was, his head turned back with his big grin. His arm was outstretched, and he gave me this huge thumbs up. I sat in my car, and I cried, and I cried, because it wasn't always like this. It wasn't many years ago that he was a 2-year-old who had lots of energy, who couldn't sleep most nights. It wasn't unusual for him to be up until midnight. He was inquisitive. By the time he was 3, he had already short-circuited the phone system in our house. He had already disconnected the electrical switches. And one afternoon when I put him down for a nap, I went and did some laundry, and then I heard noises downstairs. What I found out is there was my 2.5-year-old playing with all the deadbolt door locks that he had already disassembled. You had to constantly watch him. He was always moving. He wasn't noisy. He was just busier than my other kids. At daycare, he was just as busy, and the staff, they just couldn't keep up with him. When they put the kids down for a nap, he wouldn't nap. Instead, he would turn on the lights, he would take the blankets off the other kids and wake them up. He wanted to play. But he didn't play well with other kids. When they had something he wanted, he would reach over, he would grab it out of their hand, or he might just push them out of the way. At other times, he would walk across the tables, he would jump to the floor over and over again, as if it was a game, to see how many times he could repeat the pattern before he got caught. Soon the other kids followed, and the daycare called me, asking me to find another place for my son. He wasn't even three, and here we were, disenrolled from daycare. On his third birthday, I took him for an assessment with a neuropsychologist. It was hard to get the name of a neuropsychologist and a doctor to help my son. I sat many days at the pediatrician's office asking for help. My pediatrician told me boys will be boys and he'll outgrow it. Not Matt. The neuropsychologist told me he had ADHD, and she referred us to a psychologist to teach us behavior management strategies. We tried some new ways of parenting. I set up sticker charts and I set up rewards for appropriate behavior. It didn't change anything. My son was very hyperactive and he couldn't control his impulses, nor could he settle himself down to sleep at night. I tried holding him, I tried rocking him to soothe him, but he didn't like to be touched either, so he fought back. We eventually found a new daycare and staff that could work with him on most days, but he was different. He could play quietly, he could seem okay. Then something would glaze over in his eyes, it was like he turned on a switch, and he was a different kid. He was running everywhere, talking back to staff, throwing books and pencils, kicking chairs. Eventually, you could catch him and you could hold him until he calmed down and until that episode passed. Sometimes these episodes would happen several times a day. These behaviors, which later would be symptoms of his illness, continued as he entered elementary school. By now, we had changed therapists and began working with one that specialized in children's mental health issues. Shortly after my son began kindergarten, he was hospitalized in a children's psychiatric hospital. His rages had intensified, lasting close to 45 minutes. It was difficult to manage him at home. When he was in a rage, he would knock over the lamps, the chairs, he would run rapidly through the house, laughing hysterically. It was these rages and meltdowns that occurred out of nowhere that led doctors to believe he was experiencing episodes of mania. This was in 1995. He was 5 years old. Again, I just wanted to hold him through it, but he didn't like being held. He wasn't able to communicate and tell me how he felt or what was really going on inside. So he and I came up with a signal for him to tell me he was okay. It was a simple thumbs up. I contacted the county social services and they signed us a social worker who met with us. They set us up with a program that brought a young man out to our house 1 week in a month for about 4 hours to help with Matt. It provided him more structure and allowed us an opportunity that I could take all three of my kids on outings in the community. It was the first time that the kids and I went to the zoo. It was the first time I took my kids to a park, the first time I ever took my kids to a museum. We were always isolated in our home because we never knew how Matt would behave when we were out in public. So our whole structure of our house revolved around Matt and his moods. But 4 hours once a month wasn't enough. Matt needed more than weekly therapy, and he needed someone to meet with us more than just one afternoon a month. His behaviors continued to intensify. He struggled in school, he was frequently suspended, and charges were brought up against him in juvenile court. Over the years, he was hospitalized 8 times and spent 1 year in residential treatment. We were struggling to manage his moods, his explosive behaviors, and hyperactivity. Very few people understood my son. Most people blamed me for his behaviors. As a single parent, I was often told it was my fault, that I just needed to provide more structure and more discipline. I can't tell you how many times people stared at me in the grocery store, at the library, and even in church, just watching my child melt down, offering me no help, just harsh words and judgment. When Matt was 10, we moved to Minnesota, and I contacted the county social services and was assigned a social worker. She helped me find the services and supports for Matt. She listened. She helped us apply for TEFRA so my son could get medical assistance, and eventually he received a community waiver. That waiver allowed us access to services that the insurance company didn't cover. We got CTSS, Children's Therapeutic Services and Support, PCAs, personal care attendants, in-home behavior therapists, and sensory integration training. These services were brought to our home. and these are the supports we needed to provide the structure and consistency to help Matt. The social worker attended my son's school meetings. She helped with his individualized education program. She was at the hospital meetings, and she went to the juvenile court hearings. She was always helping me advocate for Matt. Finally, when he was 12, he received a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, and at 14, a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. It was no longer my fault. There was a medical reason for Matt's behaviors and Matt's moods. There are a lot of families like mine that struggle to find the right diagnosis, to access the services and supports in the community that their children so desperately need. Often the barriers that we face are finances and time. Not all services are covered by medical insurance. Not all families can afford the high parental fees that are associated with TEFRA. And most families can't take the time off work for the multiple weekly therapies and the meetings with the schools. They feel blamed and misunderstood. It places a lot of stress on families, especially the siblings. There was a time I didn't think my son would graduate from high school. He was failing math. But along the way, he was starting to make some progress. They were baby steps, as his therapist reminded me every week. It was hard. He's bright, and he nearly aced his ACT, scoring a 35 on the first try. He only missed two questions, as he says, in English, which is his weakest subject. 4 years ago, he did graduate from high school. He was at the top of his class. From there, he enrolled at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, and he was the recipient of multiple scholarships. This past May, I watched him graduate again. Magna cum laude, as he would tell you, with a double major in mathematics. Go figure, he failed mathematics in sixth grade, but he has a Bachelor of Mathematics and a Bachelor's of Science in Computer Engineering. Just this last October, he began full-time employment with a major software engineering firm, and he's earning close to $60,000 a year. He's 23 years old, he's pursuing a master's degree, and we're working on finding him an apartment because he's decided it's time to move out and be on his own. So how did we get here? If you ask my son, he'll tell you that it was the team of people. It was having everybody in place, from the social worker to the psychologist, the psychiatrist, the school mental health support, and mental health workers. The CTSS providers, the PCAs, and all the specialists working together as a team. That's what made a difference. Knowing all those people were there, wanting him to succeed, changed his world, and it certainly changed mine. So as I watched this young man walk across that college campus a couple years ago, with his head turned back with that big old grin, his arm outstretched with the big old thumb up, I knew we made it. I knew it was going to be okay. So I'm asking you to give mental health and mental health care for children a huge thumbs up. Every child in Minnesota and every family have the right to expect mental health treatment, the funding for services and supports in their community that they need. Every child has the right to succeed and live a life functional like my son does. Parents can't do it alone. We need a team, and we need you to be on our team. I'm counting on you to be on that team. And I'm asking you to stretch out your arm and give mental health care a thumbs up. Let us know. Please, let us know it's going to be okay.
Thank you. Sue, how long is the last one? Because that's the important part. Everybody wants the last one so that we know. Okay, thank you. Because we need questions. Greg?
Yes. Are you?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gregory Michael, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. My grandfather emigrated here from Greece in the mid-1950s. When he came to America, he brought along with him $50. His brothers, his mother and father, and sexual, physical, and emotional abuse that lasted years before they came to America and will last years afterwards. In my family, a cycle of abuse led to mental illness, leaving me at the end. My mother's emotional scars from her childhood left her with multiple personalities that she would alter to. All this culminated in 2007, when my after my father's suicide attempt, when she transitioned between a teenager and a small child for months at a time. The stress from this caused a psychotic breakdown, and I locked myself in my room for the next 3 years. Partly to escape my parents' mental illnesses and their symptoms, and to escape into my own mindscape to begin a lifetime of self-awareness and therapy. My dark days, I heard nonstop paranoid ramblings from about aliens and demons from my dad. I was told black vans were watching us. I heard voices speaking outside my head, and I would sleep in my closet to escape the cameras in our house. And everyone was laughing at me, and everyone was whispering my name all the time. The years after I escaped the confines of my room and my agoraphobia, in 2009, I was invited to take part of the Dakota County Committee on Children's Mental Health, of which I was recently elected a vice chairman, and I really appreciate that. I've been teaching a support group for teenagers from NAMI, which has given me a great deal of more insight into the current problems that mentally ill children have nowadays. I have received my permit and GED and am currently trying to get into an art college. I recommend that you support funding for children's mental health. I see some really bad things going on, especially with early onset. Misdiagnoses, no diagnoses, blanket diagnosis. I believe this problem could be remedied if you put a therapist in every school, including elementary. Besides diagnoses and treatment, if this is done, I also believe it could help every child with average anxiety, anger, and restlessness. Solutions to problems like these will echo throughout lifetimes. I'm sorry. Solutions like these will echo throughout not only lifetimes but also generations.
Thank you. Maya?
Hi, my name is Maya Smedberg, and I'm here today to give testimony on my experience of mental illness as a child and adolescent. I struggled with severe depression, social anxiety, and an eating disorder from the age of 12 through 18 without receiving any help or treatment. Because I excelled academically and didn't cause any trouble, all the warning signs were overlooked, and I unfortunately fell through the cracks. My family thought I'd grow out of it, that I was just being a moody teenager because that's what society told them. My teachers must have noticed how quiet and isolated I was, that I rarely spoke and ate lunch alone, and that some of my English writing assignments were dark and depressing, but nobody intervened. Maybe they didn't know what to do. I knew that something was wrong, but nobody asked me, and I was too afraid and ashamed to ask for help. Because I didn't get any professional help as a child, my depression and anxiety got progressively worse, and I missed out on all the normal milestones of being a teenager. I didn't go to prom or homecoming or have birthday parties with friends. Instead, I grew increasingly isolated, and the unhealthy coping behaviors I used, such as self-injury, were ingrained in me. Every time I ate lunch in a bathroom stall because the lunchroom overwhelmed me with anxiety, my avoidant behavior was reinforced. If someone had noticed how unhappy I was and gotten me help, my depression and anxiety could have been treated with medication. I could have been taught to use healthy coping skills and talk about my feelings instead of carving it out on my body. Thankfully, I am in recovery now, but struggling for so many years without treatment made getting to where I am today so much harder than it needed to be. Children should not have to seek out help. It should be offered to them. And no child in this country should have to suffer with a treatable mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this a panel? Okay.
Mr. Chairman and representatives.
If you're first, go ahead.
Pardon?
If you're first, go ahead.
Okay. I am first.
Okay.
I'm Deborah Saxlug, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association for Children's Mental Health, commonly known as MACMA. MACMA's mission is to promote the positive mental health for all infants, children, adolescents, and their families. A statistic that you've heard several times over the course of the last 2 days is that fewer than 20% of youth that need mental health treatment actually receive it. For some, the problem is a lack of insurance. For others, it's a lack of appropriate providers or reasonable access to services. For all of them, however, the stigma of mental illness is one of the most significant barriers to having their mental health needs met. For youth, the fear of social rejection, and for parents, the fear of being blamed, often prevents them from seeking necessary services. The message from the South High students today brings home the importance of educating middle school and high school students about mental health. Educating students about mental health increases their compassion, understanding, and acceptance of their peers that struggle with mental illness. This understanding and acceptance is an important part of eliminating the stigma youth with mental illness face. Yesterday, we heard from Drs. Michael Buston Sanders about programs and school-linked mental health services that are working. Another school-based initiative that is working and has data to support it is Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports, or PBIS. PBIS is a broad range of individualized strategies for achieving important social and learning outcomes while preventing behavioral problems. Schools implementing PBIS are reporting teaching environments that are less reactive, aversive, dangerous, and exclusionary, that decrease classroom management and disciplinary issues, and improve supports for students whose behaviors require more specialized assistance, such as those having emotional or behavioral disorders or mental health problems. It's very important to sustain and increase this initiative. Educators, however, will continue to need more support and education to deal with the increasing and complex mental health and behavioral problems of children in their classroom. To more effectively educate children with mental health disorders, maintain peaceful classrooms, and create better learning environments for all students, educators and support personnel would greatly benefit from ongoing collaboration with mental health professionals and advanced training on children's mental health disorders and effective strategies for education and classroom management.
Mr. Chair and Committee, Mary Regan, Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. Well, I mean, this panel is billed as what can we do, and I think as you've heard, there's lots to do. And it's hard to sometimes narrow down what from the many things that are possible, but we have tried to do that. In particular, there are some things that we really believe, if funded, if added to the medical assistance in Minnesota care benefit set, would start to improve some of the transition and coordination issues that we see. For example, clinical consultation, where the professional, mental health professional that's working with the child and family would be able to consult with the child's physician or the child's neuropsychologist, for example, to make sure that what they're doing is coordinated and is compatible to make things better. There's something called a family peer specialist. Right now we do fund peer specialists for adult services, and these are adults with mental illness who are working to help other adults understand the disorder and provide support. Imagine having somebody like Suzette available to families to help them understand and get support around the fact that this happens to other families. Families do feel blamed. Imagine having another family with that same situation be there for support. Paying for family psychoeducation. I talked earlier about the lack of time for providers to really sit down with families, explain what their child's mental illness is in a way that they can grasp. People don't get, none of us get the first explanation of any kind of disorder the first time we hear it, especially if it's about us or our family member. So this is an ongoing thing that would, I think, begin to make a difference. I reported on outcome measures and evaluation that we do on our residential treatment centers. We don't really have the ability right now to do a comprehensive look at some of these other services like CTSS. There are outcome-approved tools that providers do use in their own agencies, but despite the attempts and best hopes of the department, it's very difficult for them to take the time to get all of that information into a system where better analysis could be done. There are health plans, and there are some of the managed care plans that are willing to pay providers to do some of that work, and I think in the long run it would be very helpful. We need to clarify this payer of last resort language that stops schools from feeling comfortable to identify mental health problems in kids. There's a lot of concern that if they are the identifiers, they will end up paying the bill. We need to clarify that. We need to cover in-reach services. We do that now with hospitals, but we need to do that with residential treatment. We need to let providers who are working in the community start to connect with the children that are going to be coming back before they leave so that there's more continuity of care. And providers really would like the opportunity to have input to the contracts with the health plans. The managed care companies are charged with managing the medical assistance benefit, and mental health providers and children's providers in general, because we're such a small portion of their business, I think, I have run into a lot of problems. And we would really like the opportunity to provide feedback to the commissioner as they're making the decisions about those plans on functioning. When a provider that's operating on the margins right now doesn't get paid for 3 months because there's a glitch in the health plan system, and despite what the provider does with multiple contacts, still can't get that fixed, that can jeopardize the treatment for these kids that really need it. And I think that's as far as I'm going to go.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm Glenna Sedwell, and I'm the director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. Yesterday, I spoke about the 2007 Mental Health Initiative and particularly about the infrastructure investments that were made available to us at a grant program, and made the comment that roughly half of the need that we had estimated at that time was provided for in that 2007 initiative. So I want to do just a quick tick off of the six major programs that are part of those infrastructure investments and just make some comments in relation to the testimony that you've heard the last 2 days about where we are statewide in really making sure those things could be available and what it would take. So you heard a lot about school-linked mental health grants, whereas many of the testifiers talked about the possibilities of a mental health professional in every school. That may be a bit overwhelming to the workforce issues that many of you commented on yesterday, but we did estimate in 2007 that we probably could have twice the penetration that we actually do right now. The mobile crisis grants is a place where we have taken an appropriation and actually created a system that is in about two-thirds of the counties, but covers about 75 and 80% of the population. We have some very rural, remote counties that still do not have access to mobile crisis services. Some of the infrastructure for this, though, really could be addressed by looking at regional combinations to include some of those counties in existing programs, and so that may also be a possibility. We heard a lot about the need for more culturally specific providers, and we have a system of supports for culturally specific agencies that are willing to train and supervise more professionals from and for their communities. And I will just comment that there's almost no end to the demand or the need for doing more of that. Respite care that ended up being so important for the family stories that we've heard is something that we're able to provide to about two-thirds of counties at this time. We do evidence-based practice training and especially trauma-related training, and you heard from Dr. Gewirtz about the wonderful partnership that we have had with the AMBIT network at the University of Minnesota, and obviously we have a lot more providers who could benefit from that training. And then finally, we also have an extensive program for early childhood mental health professionals so that we can emphasize that early identification that you heard just pervading all of the testimony. And while we've worked very hard to get that into every county in the state, it still is a very small number of providers. So that's where we are in the infrastructure.
Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I'll just wrap it up here. There's two workforce issues. We really would like to have the Higher Education Commission and the Minnesota Children's Mental Health Division hold a summit and say, what is it that we need in our workforce? How can we get more mental health professionals and practitioners? How can we increase the number of culturally specific providers? And how can we ensure that the workforce is adequately educated to actually work in the field of children and work with children who have a mental illness? We'd like to create a certification process for behavioral health aides, too, and increase the payment rates. Right now, the provider has to actually train the person to become a behavioral health aide, too, and we have very few of them. Well, what if our community colleges did that like we did for community health workers, so it would be upon the individual to get the training, and then they could get a higher-paying job because they actually did that? There are a couple of other things within the Children's Mental Health Division that, system that we'd like to see. One is contract beds for inpatient care, which we do for adults now so that they can stay longer beyond their insurance. This would, again, help kids become more stabilized. We'd like to see mental health first aid training for people who work with youth, including school resource officers, social workers, you know, juvenile justice professionals. We'd like to make sure that community health workers who can now operate under the supervision of a mental health professional actually get training on children's mental health so that we can expand our workforce that way. And another thing is to require children's mental health case managers to continue beyond age 18 all the way to 26. As I say often, 26 is the new 18. And if you can imagine being in the children's mental health system, you turn 18 and all of a sudden that's it. That doesn't work very well. We already know these kids have high needs. We want to continue that on until they're really able to leave kind of the children's system and move into the adult system with a transition plan as well. I'd also like to just, while we heard a little testimony on this about, you know, kids dropping off into shelters, you also have to know there's another piece of that where a parent will bring their child to the emergency room. The emergency room says, you know, we don't think they meet that level of care, and we don't have any open beds, so you need to take the child home. And the parent says, but I can't keep them safe. I think that they're too ill to bring home, or I'm afraid that they might hurt my other children. I can't take them home. And what actually happens is a police officer comes, they do a safety hold, they bring the child to a shelter, and the parent is charged with medical neglect. Now, I don't think that's neglect. I think that is advocacy on behalf of your child. And so I think we really need to look at the child welfare laws to make sure that we're not penalizing families who really are trying to get their kids the treatment that they need. And then lastly, we have kind of a new issue in the children and adult mental health field, and that is the first episode. So the very first time that a child or an adolescent or a young adult has a psychotic episode. You know, when you have cancer, they don't say to you, well, come back when you hit stage 4. They don't do that. We do that in the mental health system. We say, we're going to wait till you've been hospitalized multiple times or till you've ended up in jail or till you've ended up homeless. Then we'll give you a case manager. Then maybe we'll look at some intensive services. We need to be providing the most intensive services, the evidence-based medication that goes with that child and that youth, and make sure that they get everything that they need so the trajectory of their life doesn't change. And so we'd like to make sure that we actually provide those intensive services. We'd like to make sure that those young adults who are parents get child care so they can go to treatment. And we'd like to make sure that health plans don't tell you to do step therapy and use the oldest and cheapest medication first, but that they use the medication that we actually know works. I really thank you for having 2 days of hearings on what we think is an incredibly important topic. As you can see, we actually, I think, know what we can do and what works. We just have to have the will to do it. And I know everyone who testified today would be happy to answer any questions.
And I want to thank all of you, and the committee wants to thank all of you. This is a big issue and one that's important, and a committee like this that is supposed to look at bringing the different agencies together to work on things is that's part of our job now, is to try and get things. And one of you, I thought it was funny, mentioned that DOC, I think it was
Linda
Hansen, that said DOC should be in the children's cabinet. It's only about a week since I had a huge argument with the DOE commissioner about that issue, because I wanted them as part of the cabinet, and I was told that the children's cabinet didn't think so. It's Representative Briner. You're the first one with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to really, truly, deeply thank those who told their personal stories today, because that's a very courageous thing to do. And it brings home issues to us, I think, in a way that all amounts of data don't have the same power. So thank you for that. But then I would like to ask those who testified on this panel if we could have your recommendations in writing, because there were many recommendations and some detailed pieces, and I think we need to see those laid out so that we can have a better idea how we might proceed.
And Mr. Chairman, if you might, and committee members, we are actually putting together a series of bills on all the recommendations that we've presented here this afternoon, and so that we can really move forward. And if it's, you know, one bill that you can pass or all eight or nine of them, that would be wonderful.
Thank you. For the record, that was Ms. Abderhold for the tape.
Yes, and any one of you who'd like to co-author, please just let me know.
Were there any other questions? I have some, but I was waiting for everybody else. Okay, I guess I'll start. the JDAI, I think that was Linda again. You mentioned the, now, I remember several years ago being over at the Supreme Court and telling them, well, mostly it was one Supreme Court Justice, Paul Anderson, who agreed with me, but the district judges didn't, and I was trying to get juvenile delinquency files worked on together with CHIPS files, and was told that it couldn't ever be done. Of course, now they're starting to do that because Georgetown University said that it was a good idea. But one of the problems is that I know in some places where they're trying to coordinate these things, the schools are not allowing any information, and the social workers, probation officers, etc., the judges are saying that they think they need the schools. Have you found that to be true at all, or have you heard of that? I think you said you're Dakota.
Yes, we're in Dakota, and I can say for our county, I think we are making some positive movement with that, as acting as partners versus different silos, and we see some promise in that. I think that Dr. Michael Bust also mentioned it's the school's intention to keep kids in school, and they're really struggling with how to do that. And so we're working very hard. We've put in we in Dakota County have tried different programs to support the school so that they see us as partners. But I think schools are coming on board with recognizing that we can't remain in silos, and we all have to do it together. It isn't juvenile justice. It isn't school. It isn't the police. It is all of us together. So I think your point is well taken. It's very difficult to get systems to collaborate. It's very difficult, but we are making some progress. And I think that is the intention of Juvenile Detention Alternatives, is to look at all of the systems together rather than separately. And the outcomes are just extremely promising. The detention rates have absolutely fallen. The schools are now charged with, we don't let them in the doors without meeting criteria that these are kids that are unsafe in our community, or they won't attend their court hearings. So schools do have to find another way to be able to handle those situations.
Another question I guess I brought up was I think it's a superintendent from Canby mentioned that because of the way the funding is set up, it's hard to get the providers to go from 100 miles away from where they are to the schools. Does anybody know about that issue, or is anything being done here that they know about to solve that issue? Mary, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Mary Regan. Medical assistance will pay for travel to a medical assistance approved service, but the rate is very, very low, and there is no payment for the time. So the dilemma is that if it's 80 miles away, it's expensive to do. Ideally, you want to have the opportunity to work in a community with schools a little closer together, but certainly there are programs that travel many, many distances across the state to provide school-linked services. The advantage of the grant is the grant can cover some of those kinds of costs, whereas straight fee-for-service doesn't. So that's another advantage to the school-linked grants.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? I know Democrats have caucus in 5 minutes, and I don't know if you have any tonight. Okay, well, then I guess we're adjourned for tonight. Thank you.